Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Matthew Tosillo of Pomerantz LLP, representing plaintiffs' appellants in this consolidated appeal of a securities fraud class action. I wish to please reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This court held in Eminence Capital that in the, quote, technical and demanding area of federal securities class actions, the acid test is a motion to dismiss, and adherence to Rule 15 principles is especially important. That is particularly true in this lawsuit concerning a multi-year class period of public statements before and after the disastrous Aliso Canyon gas leak. Here, the district court had only ruled on the pleadings once before it dismissed the lawsuit with prejudice. It dismissed the first amended complainer, FAC, without prejudice for failure to plead two elements of the Exchange Act 10B claims, falsity and scienter. The district court then conceded that the plaintiff's next pleading, the second amended complaint, or SAC, sufficiently pled one of those two, falsity, which showed not only bona fide progress, but frankly was more progress than the plaintiffs in Eminence Capital had shown, because the decision on appeal there still had both falsity and scienter inadequately pled. Both pleadings here, the FAC and the SAC, expressly alleged that the long-awaited root cause analysis, which we now know defendants obstructed and delayed, would, quote, substantially support their claims. Yet the second motion to dismiss order failed to identify which misstatements were pled as false, and it dismissed with prejudice on scienter grounds. The district court refused leave to amend further on futility grounds, despite a deluge of new relevant information, including both interim and final root cause analyses that plaintiffs laid out in first the Third Amendment Complaint 1 and Third Amendment Complaint 2. Significantly, pertinent facts are still developing, prompting plaintiffs to file 4 judicial notice motions today, both before the district court and this court. Most recently, SoCalGas judicially admitted in testimony before the CPUC SED proceedings, quote, the personal involvement of the highest levels of SoCalGas management and, quote, executive leadership in the safety oversight of and response to the gas leak. It also judicially admitted that no modeling whatsoever was done for the first of 4 failed top kill attempts of the gas leak.
And did you bring that to the attention of the district court, or is this something that is newly raised?
I'm sorry, say it again, Your Honor.
Did you specifically bring that evidence before the district court, or is this something you're now asking us to take judicial notice of on appeal?
So the run through of new information that I've laid out, kind of in summary, much of it was before the district court, the root cause analysis, et cetera.
Well, I'm asking you specifically with regard to the last statement you made, which I assume you refer to an admission on behalf of the company. Was that before the district court when it ruled or not?
No, that is new information that postdated the district court's order.
So why, under the normal rules of appellate procedure, would we want to take judicial notice of facts that were not in evidence before the district court when it ruled?
Judicial notice, Federal Rule of Evidence 201D says the court may take judicial notice at any stage, and it may be done in the trial court or on appeal, according to the advisory committee notes, but the task.
But you want to introduce it as evidence of the as fact when I assume it is hotly contested by the defendants exactly how much involvement their senior officials had in the minutia of, for example, the mechanics of well SS-25.
Well, again, the judicial admission concerns the personal involvement of the highest levels of SoCalGas in the oversight of the gas leak, the response
Doesn't that suffer from the same factual deficiency that the district court was concerned about? The district court kept telling you, I want to know who, what, when, where, why, and how. And that doesn't answer that question, does it?
Well,
tell us which senior officials of the company, and you've named only 2 of them.
We did plead the who, what, when, where, and how of the statements. Telabs disclaims the need for, quote, smoking gun evidence of scienter. Here we have the defendant Reed is the CEO of Sempra, the parent, and defendant Areola is the CEO of SoCalGas, the subsidiary. If the judicial admission about the highest levels of SoCalGas and executive leadership overseeing the gas leak doesn't concern the CEO of SoCalGas. I don't know who it would concern. And the task here on appeal under Eminence Capital is just to figure out whether it appears the plaintiffs have a reasonable chance of successfully stating a claim if given another opportunity. These are all.
Yeah, I guess the concern I have is that this litigation is taking on aspects of a moving target as far as the district court is concerned. I mean, you keep wanting to raise new allegations, and you're asking the Ninth Circuit now to reverse the district court on the basis of a factual allegation that was never presented to the district court. And well, I'm having a little bit of trouble.
The moving target
is why we should grant your motion for judicial notice under these circumstances.
The moving target is a fair concern, but blame squarely lies with the defendants here. The CPUC is now among the 330 violations that they are pursuing against Sempra and SoCalGas are scores of them related to obstruction. And in particular, SoCalGas did a data dump on the third-party entity Blade that was engaged to do the root cause analysis. They provided documents, 25,000 pages of documents in March of 2019 to requests that had been made back in 2016. That obstruction, which directly evidences Scienter, incidentally, that obstruction delayed the issuance of the root cause analysis until 2 months after that production in May of 2019.
And was that factual allegation before the district court when it ruled?
So we did, we put the... The data dump was part of a judicial notice motion that was in line with the judicial notice motion of the root cause analysis itself. So it was in front of the district court when it ruled upon the one of the reconsideration motions.
Okay.
What seems like, admittedly, something like Scienter, or if we have something similar like specific intent, people rarely exactly admit things. But so circumstantial evidence can be pulled together to show scienter or specific intent, but you have to somehow link it to something. And what I'm having problems with is like you threw the kitchen sink against the wall, but you're not really, you're not tying your allegations to specific statements that the scienter would relate to. So I just see a whole bunch of stuff thrown against the wall, but I can't pull the link together.
Well, let's focus on the gas leak allegations. They're a little more discreet, a little easier to highlight. During that period, SoCalGas went door to door, reassured residents that there was, quote, no threat to public safety. It does not pose an imminent threat to public health. At the time, we know that these allegations, by the way, are uncontested on appeal. The gas leak was spewing out toxic air pollutants at levels based on the CARB issued data. This is data that was available in real time during the gas leak. Our expert calculated the levels of air pollutants that were being released, which not only posed a hazard, they also triggered reporting obligations. During that time, SoCalGas and Sempra were saying there's no health risk, and defendant Areola himself was talking. His post-leak comments were regarding, you know, apologizing for the bad smell, or saying that, you know, we were doing everything we can as quickly as possible, and we're worried about the odorant, you know, the scent of this leak. And that's months into the leak.
Counsel, where in your third amended complaint do you specify the date on which the company knew this information and what it knew on that date? I read your 292 pages or whatever it was. I didn't see it.
So we have a combination of what they knew and what they should have known, right? So they're deliberately reckless in not knowing. So we have, they knew as of October in the 20s that they were getting health complaints reported at the rate of 200 a month, okay?
And the problem I'm having with your argument is that it's the same concern Judge Callahan just articulated. You make this general conclusory allegation, but then when I ask, okay, who within the company knew that information, your complaint doesn't answer that. It assumes that because a public health entity, say the Los Angeles County Department of Health, received X number of complaints over a certain period of time, that somehow somebody in the company knew that. But you don't say who, you don't say when, and you don't say what they were told by the LA County Department of Health.
The complaint does allege that all those health risks were equally reported in real time to the company. It also, you know, again, we so I see my time is up. I'll answer this question and reserve if that's all right with the panel. There's deliberate recklessness because they touted engagement of a quote, world-class team of experts. Our expert, in uncontested allegations, calculated the release of toxic air pollutants at levels that caused the very health complaints that we allege were provided to the company at a clip of hundreds a month during the entire gas leak, the whole time. And they judicially admit, as I pointed out, the obvious, really, that the highest levels of SoCal gas were monitoring the leak, and every post-leak statement, all these press releases, have the logo of Sempra and SoCal Gas on them. They're posted to the corporate website. We allege the core operations doctrine. This is the biggest facility within the panoply of things that this company does, and it's a catastrophe of epic proportions, the gas leak, with billions of dollars in potential liabilities.
All right. Do either of my panel members have a question that they'd like to ask before? And okay, otherwise you can reserve the balance. Thank you. All right. We'll hear from the appellee.
May it please the court, Thomas Peterson for the appellee. The issues surrounding the gas leak at Aliso Canyon are in the course of being addressed in the California State Court tort litigation and before the California Public Utilities Commission in administrative proceedings. And that's where they belong and where they will be resolved. And the district judge here quite correctly concluded that there is no federal securities fraud cause of action in this case. And in particular, what's missing is the requirement of adequate pleading of scienter under what this court has called the daunting standards of the Reform Act. I'm sure the court has this focus in mind, but when we're speaking about what the scienter allegations have to show, they have to show with respect to extreme recklessness, conduct which approaches intent, something which is greater than even inexcusable negligence.
Okay, but this was a big leak. This was a big leak. And the November 2015 prospectus makes no mention of the gas leak. Granted, the leak was publicly known, but did that information available to the public deviate in any material respect from what the company knew at the time?
Your Honor, the prospectus we're talking about is a sale of notes. It's not stock. It's a prospectus which, as the district judge said, involves information that was widely known with respect to the existence of the leak. And there's no suggestion, and that disclosure which the company was providing included a whole series of press releases and other information, as well as working on an interactive basis with the state regulator, the Dogger agency. And there's no suggestion, the plaintiffs have never been able to allege what it is that the company should have disclosed. And let's keep in mind when we think about that in an omissions case, you not only have to satisfy the scienter requirement with respect to, as Your Honor, Judge Callahan said a few moments ago, you have to show it with respect to specific statements and omissions and link it up to particular individuals. But with respect to an omission, it has to be information that is so obvious that the actor must have been aware of it. That's from this court's DASM global case. And so
here's a little fact that bothers me. The Sempra CEO made her largest ever sale of stock days before the governor proclaimed the leak a state emergency. You point out she just received her largest ever stock award, but does the record establish that her 2016 sale was consistent with her prior trading history?
It does, Your Honor. If you look, the record has in it earlier sales that Ms. Reed undertook. And those sales are a consistent pattern of selling the stock necessary to pay the taxes that she would be expected to pay as a result of the award. And if you look at the award of stock, It was approximately 140,000 shares, and she sold 72,000 shares, which if you do the arithmetic, roughly puts you at the highest tax brackets for the Fed at federal and California returns. And under this court's Ronconi case, which sets out the steps you look at with respect to a stock sale or financial interest analysis of that sort, the third is that it's not probative if it's consistent with the longstanding pattern of past sales.
What was their pattern the year before?
It was a consistent pattern of selling an amount of stock which is reasonably calibrated to pay the taxes that she would have been expected to receive. Now, it's true that she received more shares in 2016 than she had in past years, but her sales amounts were appropriately calibrated with respect to the taxes that you would expect to owe for the amount that she received. And with respect to Ms. Reed, I think it's also important to emphasize there's no allegation anywhere in the complaint that links her to any statement. She's not attributed as a speaker with respect to any of the statements that are made, nor to any of the omissions that are alleged in the case. And with respect to the other defendant, Mr. Arriola, his statements are, for the most part, they are, I think, it can all be characterized as apologies for the fact the leak is going on. Statements that he will take step, they're taking steps to try to deal with it and address it in real time. And then his statement that he made to the president of the Public Utilities Commission that working with Dogger, they were working to preserve all of the necessary evidence. But given the urgent situation people were trying to deal with, that they couldn't be assured that everything would be protected. And that's hardly indicative of scienter, given you're telling that to your leading regulator.
Can we invoke the core
operations? I beg your pardon, Your Honor.
Can we invoke the core operations theory here, given that the Liso Canyon wells constituted a very large percentage of the revenues for Southern California Gas? You can say, I know it's a technical issue, but on the other hand, if you think of other companies, I mean, I'm sure if there's a potential technical issue with the iPhone, Tim Cook would be very involved and would know every small detail when it involves a substantial portion of the company's revenue. So can we invoke that here?
No, Your Honor, this is not a suitable case for invoking the core or collective's core operation or collective scienter concept. And in answering your question, let me start by observing that this court has observed in the Glazer case and then in the NVIDIA case that it's never actually adopted this concept, as to which there's some disagreement in the circuits about whether it really applies. But you don't have to decide in this case for sure whether you want to adopt it or not, because if you look at the facts here, we're talking about one of 115 wells at one of several storage facilities of a company which is involved in the distribution of natural gas, to be sure. But as to that business, it has several different components. It's not just storing the gas, it's acquiring it, it's shipping it, it's delivering it to customers. So this is not the kind of situation which rises to the level of being a fact, which is so obvious in the language of the DSAM Global case, so obvious that it would be absurd to think that an actor would not be aware of it. It doesn't factually lend itself to that sort of characterization. And I think the best illustration of that is if you look at, as I suspect you have, Judge Posner's decision in the Seventh Circuit in the Telab case on remand, where he used as an illustration of what might satisfy the test a representation that General Motors had sold 1 million cars when it had sold none. We're not talking about anything which is comparable to that kind of a situation. I'd like to turn back, if I may, to some of the points that were made by my friend on the other side with respect to the development of the record in this case. And let's start with the pleadings that were reviewed in this case. It is the case, actually, that the plaintiff had three opportunities to present a complaint, and the district court scrutinized those pleadings twice and concluded, and concluded that scienter was not present, and it is incorrect for my friend to suggest that in the second go-round, the court decided that falsity had been adequately pleaded. In fact, if you look at the judge's decision, there's a footnote in which he makes very clear that he's not he wasn't deciding the question of falsity. And as we pointed out in our briefing, if you don't agree that this case should go out on scienter, you could certainly turn and affirm it for the lack of demonstrating falsity. The next thing to keep in mind is, with respect to this, as Judge Tallman observed, this sort of moving target feature of this case, let's remember that once the judgment was entered, then the ability to make changes in the relevant pleadings becomes something which has to get reviewed under Rule 59 and Rule 60, and that's how the district judge looked at it. At the first go-round, an important factor that the plaintiffs don't want to focus on is, even with respect to the so-called Blade report, the root cause analysis that they were trying to offer at that time, the district judge recognized that the plaintiffs failed to demonstrate that was even new evidence, because much of the material that was in that pleading was something that they could have presented sooner. So that's an important reason why we shouldn't be going through this serial reopening of proceedings. And then at the next round of reconsideration with respect to the materials that were actually shared with the district judge, there the court also went through and concluded that there was nothing within those materials which would suffice to change the conclusion the court reached with respect to scienter. It didn't meet those kind of exacting, or as this court put it, daunting requirements that are necessary in order to satisfy that scienter pleading. And that makes an enormous amount of sense when you stop and think about what was in those materials. A root cause analysis is a retrospective effort to try to explain what were the possible reasons that led to the Aliso Canyon leak, and what sort of, among other things, the report talks about what sort of reforms perhaps ought to be undertaken on the part of the state, noting, for example, that while the plaintiff in this case likes to talk about the absence of a subsurface valve, that the state never required them on this sort of a well. So that kind of analysis, a look backward at what might have been or done differently, and what might have been a cause, all of which is still very much in dispute and by no means settled, all of that does not lend itself to supporting the kind of Rule 59 or Rule 60 relief that you have to demonstrate, that you have to satisfy the burdens for purposes of reopening the complaint in the case. With respect to the question about the relative safety, the contents of the gas that was being released, my friend doesn't remind you of the fact that there are, in the record, by way of request for judicial notice in support of the motion to dismiss, as to which there was no objection, there are reports, contemporaneous reports from three different public agencies, pointing out that there was not perceived to be any serious risk of health or safety risk. Those were from the California Office of Emergency Services, which is the state agency which takes care of emergency situations in the state. That was from the report of the California, I'm sorry, the report of the Los Angeles Department of Public Health, which formed the same conclusion. And it's also the conclusion that was reached by the South Coast Air Quality Management District, which had concluded that the content of the air in this particular area as a result of the leak was really no different than it would ordinarily be in Southern California. And it's a very important fact that I think gets glossed over when we talk about this, which is that this facility is actually not immediately adjacent to residential communities. And this Porter Ranch community, which is where most of the plaintiffs reside in the context of the civil litigation, it's a mile away. And so, again, going back to this kind of scienter inquiry, how could we have expected or how can we find, without some very particularized factual allegations, which you will not find present in this case, that the company or any individual in the company, and again, individuals are not specified, that they had an appreciation of the fact that the consequences of the release of the gas were going to affect in a certain way people a mile away in circumstances where it's not even at this point by any means agreed or understood that that's the case. And also the disclosures at the time included things like the acknowledgement by the public health department that the odorant, which has to go into natural gas, the mercaptan, you know, it can have an effect on people, but it's not regarded as a long-term effect. And so insofar as there were people complaining about the exposure and the gas and the smell and the like, I mean, that's the same kind of alert. And I don't mean to trivialize it by any means, but that's part of what the mercaptan is there to do, is to make sure you're aware of it so you can deal with the gas. My friend talks about this statement that is in his latest request for judicial notice, as to which there's, you know, really never been briefed because it came in so late in the record that somehow there's in the testimony before the Public Utility Commission that the highest levels of the gas company were aware of enacting and dealing, trying to address the crisis. There's the leak rather. There's no indication of who that is. And these kind of generalized statements of general awareness with respect to circumstances, I mean, this court has repeatedly suggested in cases like Glazer and in Webb that those sort of generalized assertions are insufficient to meet the pleading standards of the Reform Act. And I see that I've crossed over into my
You're both into overtime. Let me make sure that my colleagues don't have any additional questions of you. Judge Lehr, Judge Tallman, do you have any additional questions?
I don't.
All right, then thank you. We'll go back for a rebuttal from Mr. Tosillo.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to just quickly hit a few points that my worthy adversary raised. First, we only hit Rule 59 and Rule 60 standards because the company delayed the root cause analysis by several years through its data dump on Blade in 2019 of materials requested in 2016. That's part of a pattern of obstruction, which included the Los Angeles Department of Public Health saying that they were blocked from taking accurate air readings early on. They got a watered down version of what they needed and too late to impact public health. Second, there was the point about Defendant Reed not specifically being a speaker. We've briefed this issue under Janus. Both Reed and Areola are speakers, even of the things that are not specifically attributed to them, the quotation marks. They are the maker of the statement with the ultimate authority as CEOs, respectively, of Sempra and SoCalGas. Most of these post-leak statements have the logos of both companies on them. And as we've already discussed, there's the admission of high-level involvement. Third, Judge Callahan asked questions about motive. So a couple of points are worth making there. First, it is categorically untrue that the information that was known, i.e. that there was a leak, at all aligned with the realities of the leak known to the defendants for purposes of assessing that prospectus. By the point of that prospectus, a top kill had failed. The crater was widening. It was very clear this leak was not stopping anytime soon. And charitably put, it's a pretty clear attempt to raise the funds to start covering the liabilities that were dawning on the company. For Defendant Reed, the problem that the district court has and defendants is that they are taking the three Ronconi factors and morphing them into two. Those factors are amount, timing, and history. The amount is unquestionably suspicious. It's the largest ever award given at a time of ongoing catastrophe. It's the largest ever sale. 51% of the award, by the way, is sold. I'm unaware of a tax bracket that high for a $6 million gain. The timing is suspicious. 2 days before the declaration of emergency.
Hadn't she sold stock at that same time of the year before?
But that's the third factor. That's my point. There's an amount factor. There's a timing factor. Just objectively, is it suspicious or not being that close to a corrective? The answer is yes. 2 days away, a three-day delay would have cost her over $500,000. That's independently suspicious. Now, the third factor is the history. Okay, so I've got two factors already on board. The third factor is history. But to go with them on history, you have to believe this thought that when she sold on January 4th, around the time she had sold before, she had just no idea that the state of California was about to declare a state of emergency for an ongoing catastrophe. That is exceedingly unlikely. The inference doesn't even pass muster, because in all likelihood, the company and the authorities are working closely together. We know from this, the record here is massive. Governor Brown had toured the site. His sister's on the board specifically to facilitate communications. It's likely that the company, the likely inference is that they got a quick heads up.
You think a plausible inference is that Governor Brown's sister heard from her brother that he was going to issue a governor's proclamation of emergency, and she tipped off Ms. Reed, who then engaged in the stock trade.
A likely inference is that she alerted the company that it's coming so that they can get into place the thing required to comply with the edict once it passed. Well,
was this company on a calendar year fiscal basis? So would stock options be executed at the end of the December?
I apologize. I don't know the answer to that question right now. But
we do know that she had received stock in early January in prior years and had sold part of it to pay her income tax liability.
Correct. But this was twice the size of the sale, and it was in the midst of an ongoing catastrophe 2 days before that catastrophe was declared an emergency. Okay. I would close in just saying this. We did better than Eminence Capital. We moved the needle. My adversary sort of disclaimed it, but the district court said, without deciding the issue, the district court's view of the SAC indicates that at least some of the newly pleaded allegations sufficiently establish this element. And our briefing aligned the concerns that had been articulated in the FAC, for example, not calculating the amount of air pollutants released, not tying it to a reporting obligation. We aligned those specifically in our briefing. Here's what you said. Here's how we meet it. So we've done better than Eminence Capital. Here, the root cause analysis is hundreds of pages long. The supporting documents are thousands of pages of the record. It, really, what they're asking is, though we delayed that for 3 years, let's just let this case die without those allegations ever being tested on a 12B6 motion, even though the delay is our fault, and we can no longer show, under the Foeman factors, prejudice or undue delay because we caused it. That's really where we are now. This case deserves to be vetted with all of those allegations in front of the court in a 12B6 decision rendered.
All right. Thank you both for your argument. This case will now stand submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.